Okay, so let's cultivate our motivation and be thankful that we are still alive in this precious human life, that we still have the opportunities to hear, contemplate, and meditate on the teachings. That there's still the possibility to create the causes for good rebirth and liberation and enlightenment, and to practice the Dharma in each moment. And by remembering our fortune, let's feel enthusiastic about practicing. And of course, when we have that enthusiasm and apply effort, then we begin to see the results of the practice. If we have an open and relaxed mind without a lot of expectations, that is. And as we start to experience some results from our practice, then our mind becomes more enthusiastic about practicing. So it becomes a revolving wheel. But all along in this, we have to have that awareness of our fortune and a commitment to benefit sentient beings through progressing on the path to full enlightenment as a way of making best use of the fortune that we have. Let's generate that as our motivation for sharing the evening together. Some people wrote in some questions that I thought I would reply to first. Okay. So somebody said, why would we dedicate for someone else's health if they can only experience the effects of the karma they have created? Okay, because one of the factors about karma is that we only experience the effects of the causes that we have created. So what use is it to dedicate for somebody else's good health or good benefits? Well, it's true, we only experience the result of causes that we create, but to make causes ripen depends on a lot of conditions. Okay, it's not just that you have the cause and it ripens by itself. You need a whole field of conditions to make certain causes ripen. And when we dedicate for the well-being of others or for their good health or their good rebirth, we are sending out some good energy towards them and communicating on a more subtle level. And that can create the conditions so that that person's own good karma ripens. So although we can't transfer karma to them, like I was saying last week, it's not like money in a bank account that you plug in another number and it transfers to their account. But, you know, we can create the good conditions around that person so that the positive seeds in their own mind can ripen. And so that's what we're doing when we're dedicating for others, or when people request us to do pujas for them and then dedicate for them and so on. So that's what's happening there. Okay. And interestingly enough, the scientists have done some experiments and found out that people who are being prayed for do recover faster. Yeah, isn't that interesting? But I think also it helps us to make dedications for other people because it pulls us out of ourselves. You know, instead of just thinking, oh me, I have these problems, you know, we think about others and so it's actually a privilege when other people ask us to do pujas or dedications on their behalf. Okay, then there's another question. If we have karma ripened for past lives, how are we to learn from it? Because remember last time I was saying that when we experience unpleasant results, then we should recognize that it's a result of actions that we've done in previous times that were motivated by our self-centeredness, and therefore think, well, if I don't like this result, I should stop creating the cause. So this person is saying, how do you know what the cause was? Okay, because, you know, if I get sick because of actions I did eons ago, how do I know or discover what karma created the conditions for my sickness? Yeah. So that's true. We don't have omniscient mind. We don't have psychic powers, you know, that can recall previous lives. So we don't know exactly what the action was that we did that is bringing a particular unpleasant result that we're experiencing now. However, although we don't know the particular action, we can get an idea of the general kind of action that we did. So we may not know the particular circumstances. I was born as, you know, Steve Von Patrick in, you know, 500,000 eons ago, and I, you know, swore at somebody, and that's why, you know, my boss is getting on my case now. We might not see the specifics like that, but if we have certain experiences, like people getting on our case, you know, then we can assume it's from our having done similar experiences to other, caused similar experiences to other people, that we've spoken unpleasantly to them, or we haven't, we've gotten quite critical about them and haven't been very forthcoming in aiding them when they need help in completing a task. Okay, so we don't know the exact action, but we can get some idea of the approximate one. So you get that idea when you study about karma, and we'll be going into some of the topics about the results of different actions. And so from that, then you can get ideas of the kind of actions that you've done. And also in books like The Wheel of Sharp Weapons, that book is very, very good for talking about karma, and it enumerates a number of situations. You know, if you're experiencing this and that, it's the boomerang effect from actions that we've done ourselves, and then it spells out what those kind of actions were. Yeah, so it's very, very helpful. Okay, but you know, even if we can't remember what we've learned when we've studied about the results of karma, for sure we know that when we're experiencing misery, it's because of a detrimental and harmful action that we've caused. Okay, it's never because of a virtuous action. And when we experience happiness, it's always because of a virtuous action. It's never because of a harmful one. So we know that much. Okay, and then if we can learn about karma, we can learn about the kinds of things that, types of actions we could have done in the past that bring the results. I think it's equally as important not just to do this, not just when we have suffering, but also when we have happiness. Yeah, because we always say, what did I do to deserve this when we're suffering? But we need to say, what did I do to deserve this when we have happiness and when we have good fortune? And so, for those of you who are on retreat now, you know, have you spent any time thinking, what did I do to create the cause to be on retreat? Yeah? So what did I do this life? What choices did I make this life that made that karma ripen? What kind of things did I do in previous life to create the principal cause, the karma, so that, you know, I could even come? Yeah? And we all had meals today. What did we do that created the cause for us to have food today? Do we ever think about that? We always think, well, the food comes out of nowhere. Or the most I do is, you know, go to the store and buy it. You know, but usually it just kind of appears on the table out of nowhere. But that's not true. I mean, we did a lot of things in previous lives to create the cause to have the food. Did we ever stop and think what kind of things we might have done that created this cause? Because if we do, if we think of these kinds of things, then we will invigorate our practice so that we'll create more of those kinds of causes. Yeah? So that way, instead of taking things for granted, we'll really go out of our way to try and create the causes for the kind of, you know, a repeat of the kind of good circumstances that we have now. And that leads to another question, which somebody wrote to me, which is, isn't it selfish to do actions with some kind of expectation to experience certain results? You know, shouldn't we just do our actions without any kind of, you know, expectation of results, and just do what is right and do what is our duty without hoping to, you know, okay, I'm going to give a gift so I'll be rich next life. You see what I mean? You know, hoping for those kind of results. Or I'll be nice to somebody now so that they'll be nice to me in a future life. Yeah. So isn't that kind of selfish, and shouldn't we abandon those kinds of intentions? Okay. Well, even if we have that kind of intention, or we want that kind of result, it's still seeking a result that is in accord with the Dharma. Okay? So if we're thinking, like, in a future life, I want to be able to practice the Dharma, and I'm going to need food to be able to practice then. So I'm going to give food now and hope that I will receive food in the future life, so then I'll have the food to be able to practice the Dharma. That's still a good cause. Sure, we're limiting ourselves when we have that motivation, because the motivation is simply for our own benefit in a future life. But it's not for enlightenment, it's not for liberation. So in that way, we're shortchanging ourselves. But still, compared to the usual motivations we have, which is, I'll give a gift so that people will like me, you know, giving a gift with delaying the result into a future life is something virtuous compared to the usual motivation we have, which is only for the pleasure of this lifetime. Okay? So we, you know, when we are baby Buddhists, our motivation is not so grand. Yeah? Our motivation is, you know, we're normal people. It's like, I want my happiness now. Okay, happiness of this life, the 8 worldly concerns. So the first step for us is to begin to change that motivation and at least make it, you know, my happiness in future lives. Yeah, so at least stretch the motivation some. And then make it my happiness in future lives, so I'll have good conditions to practice Dharma in future lives. And then I'll do the action in order to attain liberation. And then finally, you know, in order to attain full enlightenment. So we have to stretch our mind and stretch our motivation as we progress. Yeah. So it's not bad to do something with the aim for receiving some benefit in a future life. It is limited compared to thinking about the benefit of all sentient beings. But still, it's a definite improvement over our usual motivation, which is, you know, some kind of immediate happiness or reputation or praise or something like that. Okay? So we continue to work on our motivation. Okay. Then there was another question about, you know, if we're coming into this life with karma from previous lives, how is that any different from original sin? Okay. So, you know, I'm not a Christian theologian, but so some of you may be able to help me. You may have had more of the theology than me. But the basic difference, as I see, is that the doctrine of original sin stems from Adam and Eve making a mistake, and then somehow it being passed down genetically to us, or I don't think they talked about genes in the Bible, but somehow their sin was passed down to us. Whereas in Buddhism, we don't have any negative karma that was created by other people outside of, you know, our own previous lives and the people that we were in the past. Okay? So there's always a link if we have good karmic seeds or bad karmic seeds in our mind with actions that we ourselves did, not with the actions that our ancestors did. Okay, so that's one difference. Second difference is that in Buddhism, there's no deity who is governing this process. So there's no deity who created commandments, who created good and bad. The Buddha simply described the natural functioning of what kind of karmic causes create what kind of effects. He just described it. And the Buddha is not dishing out punishments and rewards. He simply described a mechanism so that we can be aware of it and then through our own wisdom learn to act in a way that brings benefit to self and others by doing so. Okay? Those of you who are brought up with the idea of original sin who know more about it than I do, what are other differences?
Well, yeah. One big difference is that the only way to eradicate it, at least in the Protestant view, is through the sacrifice of Jesus himself. Mm-hmm. Whereas our own negative karma, we are the ones who are responsible for purifying it.
Oh, okay. So the difference on how to purify it and how to get rid of this sin is that word drives me nuts, by the way, but is through Jesus' sacrifice. So again, it's the behavior of somebody else outside of ourselves, whereas in Buddhism, we ourselves are responsible for purifying our own negative karma. Yeah. Any other differences? Yeah?
Well, I think it goes to the very inherent nature of the person the original sin doctrine is once you're born with this evil, rather than you have this inherent good within nature.
Okay.
So it's very contrasted.
Okay. So,
kind of a central constituent of the person is this original sin, and it's the negative.
Okay, so it's the viewpoint on the person. So original sin is something that is the nature of the person, something deformed or evil or rotten, you know, that is the nature of the person. Whereas in Buddhism, when we talk about karmic seeds, those are just the seeds of actions that we've created. They are not our nature. And the basic nature of the mind is something pure. Yeah, that's another big difference. Anything else? Okay. If you think of more differences, can bring them up. It's reminding me of the article that you read to us, Kath. Yeah, it's a very, very sweet article. For those who are listening, and she wrote an article. How old were you when you wrote it? And before you became a Buddhist?
When I wrote that story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I wrote that story as an adult, but it was looking back at being 6 years old.
Okay. Yeah, so she wrote a story when she was an adult, but before becoming a Buddhist, about the effects of growing up with the idea of eternal hell, yeah, and damnation, and how she dealt with that as a child. Yeah, it's a very beautiful story. Okay, so those were the questions from last week. In our book, you know, we came to the end of the section on karma, you know, what our author has written about. But I decided to talk a little bit more about karma because I think it's a very important topic. So we have the topic of, we talked about the general characteristics of karma last time. So the specific characteristics, there we're getting into talking about the 10 non-virtues and the 10 virtues. And so sometimes we say the 10 negative actions. It's not 10 negative actions, okay? It's 10 non-virtues. And these 10 are all paths of action, but they're not all actions, okay? You might remember when Kenzo Rinpoche was here, there was some confusion about it, okay? A path of action, okay, we have something here, where is it? Okay, so they're called paths of action because they're conduits leading to future lives, okay? So, in other words, it becomes a path of action when you have all four parts of the action complete, and I'll get into the four parts in a minute. And because when all four parts are complete, if the karma is strong enough, it results in a future rebirth. So it becomes a pathway to a future rebirth. Okay? Not all of these are actions, though. The seven of body and speech are action, are karma. But the three mental ones are actually afflictions. Okay? So if we go through the ten, yeah, let's start with the three physical ones. What are they? Killing, stealing, unwise and unkind sexual behavior. Four verbal ones? Lying. Disharmonious speech, harsh speech, idle talk. Okay, three mental ones? Coveting, malice, wrong views, or distorted views. Okay, if you look at those last three, covetousness, maliciousness, and distorted views or wrong views, those three are afflictions. Okay, the mental factors that are afflictions. They are not karmas because karma, mental, when we're talking mentally, karma is the mental factor of intention. Okay, so the mental factor of intention is one mental factor. Coveting is a form of greed or attachment. Maliciousness is a form of anger and hatred. Distorted views is a form of confusion. So those are other mental factors. When they arise in the mind, okay, we might have a mind that's full of greed. Well, that mind also has a mental factor of intention. That mental factor of intention is the karma. The mental factor of greed is something that makes that intention non-virtuous. Okay? Or if you have a mental factor of love, you also have in that consciousness, yeah, besides your primary mind, you have an intention. And the mental factor of love makes that whole consciousness and that intention virtuous. Now, while coveting is a form of greed, not all greed and attachment is coveting. Covetousness is only when the greed, the attachment has gotten strong enough that you really have a very firm wish and you're starting to plan how to get somebody else's possessions. okay? When it's just a random thought of attachment, that's not necessarily coveting, okay? So coveting is as an attachment that has built up over some time so that you really want it, okay? Similarly, maliciousness or ill will is not just a random thought of anger or a flash of hatred. It's something that's built up over time, so you really have a very clear mind that wants others to experience misery. Yeah. Same way with distorted views. It's not just the mental factor of any mental factor of confusion. It's when confusion has built up to a point that we're really holding distorted views and thinking that they're true. Okay? So those three are actually afflictions. If they're in the mind stream with an intention, then that intention becomes the karma. Okay? But those three, that's why we don't say the 10 non-virtuous actions, because those three aren't actions. They're, you know, they're just the mental factors that color the intention. Okay? Whereas when we act physically, when we act verbally, those are actions. The body, the speech, are the instruments that the mind is using to express. And so while that intention is the action, then, at least from the Prasangika and Vivasika system, the physical and verbal activities are also karma or action. Okay? So you get clear about that? All 10 can be pathways of action. All 10 are non-virtues, but only the first 7 are karma, are actions. Okay? Okay. Now, each karma, you know, if we're talking about karma, to have a complete karma, one that's going to be strong enough to bring a future rebirth, it has to have 4 factors. Sometimes we talk about 3 factors: preparation, actual action, and completion of the action. But most often, sometimes we talk about it that way. Sometimes we talk about it in terms of 4 factors. And which the first one's the object, the second one is the intention, the third one is the action, and the fourth is the completion of the action. Okay? So the object is, for example, in killing, it's the person that we are living being that we desire to kill. In stealing, it's the object that we intend to steal. Okay? So you have to have an object. And then when we talk about the attitude or the intention, the second factor, it has 3 parts itself. So the first part in that is discrimination, which means that we must identify the object properly. So if you intend to kill one person but you kill somebody else, it's not going to be a complete action. If you intend to steal one thing but you steal something else, it's not going to be a complete action. Okay? If you intend to lie to one person but you lie to somebody else, you know, accidentally, you didn't discriminate the people correctly, you know, then it's not a full action. Okay, then, so we have to have the correct discrimination or identification of the object. Then the second part of that is that there has to be a mental affliction present. Because without the mental affliction present, that isn't going to color the intention to be something negative. And third is that we have to have the motivation to do the action. So we must have the wish to do it. Okay? So something that's done accidentally, again, isn't going to be a complete action. Yeah? Or something that's done without an affliction being present isn't going to be a complete action. Okay? So those 3 parts are all branches of the second part. Then the third one is doing the action. Okay, so speaking the disharmonious words, lying, speaking the harsh words, whatever it is. And then the fourth is the completion of the action, which is that we, whatever we intended to be the result of the action. That's what happened. Person died. We claimed the stuff. You know, the other person, you know, believed what we said. Okay? So, you know, I won't go through all the details for each of the 10 like this, but your homework assignment is to think about this in your meditation and make examples. Okay? So, and the best way to make examples are from your own life. Okay? So if you haven't done any of the 10, then you're going to have some problem doing this homework assignment. But if you're somebody like me who's done all of the 10, you won't have any problem finding some examples. So it's very good to take out those examples and say, okay, you know, I lied to somebody. You know, we don't like to think of ourselves as liars. We like to, if anything, liar is very harsh. You know, I'm not a liar. I just sometimes lie, but I'm not a liar. Okay. But actually, my lies aren't real lies. They're little white lies. Yeah. To the tune that we're so embarrassed and ashamed of them that we don't want to ever admit to anybody we said them. But still, they're just little white lies. Okay. So take out some of those little white lies, you know. You can take out some of the big ones, too, if you want to. And look at them and say, okay, well, what was the object? Who was I lying to? Okay, what was I intending to say? Did I, you know, then you move on to the second part, your attitude or your intention. So did I identify the object correctly? Yeah. Was there a negative mental factor present? And here's where we'll sometimes go, well, it wasn't actually a negative mental factor. I mean, if I told my husband I slept with somebody else, he would just get upset, so I didn't tell him. And not only did I not tell him, I told him that I didn't do it. Yeah. You know, because I didn't want to hurt his feelings, so it was really out of compassion. Okay, so look at all those mental factors that we had that motivated the action. Yeah, and then see if there was a motivation to do the action, a wish to do it. Okay, so those are the three branches of the second factor. Then remember what the words we said. And then, you know, remember how it affected somebody else. And actually, the other person doesn't necessarily even have to believe it for it to be a lie, you know. So, even if they kind of believe it. So, you know, take out some examples. Harsh speech, it's another great one. Anybody who doesn't have any examples of harsh speech to rely on for this meditation? You know, if you don't have any examples, I can tell you some. You can meditate on mind. Okay, but go through it. And, you know, go through these different points because this is how you will come to understand about karma. If you don't go through and make these examples, it'll just remain very, very intellectual for you. And you won't feel like this teaching is really talking about you. Okay? So go through and do this. Okay. Then the 10 virtuous actions, so we just talked about the 10, or see, I did it, 10 virtues, the 10 virtues, okay, or the 10 virtuous paths of action, we can say that, okay. So if we do the 10, you know, virtuous paths of actions, those are just the abstention of the 10 negative ones, okay. So, being in a situation where you can kill and deciding not to. Okay? And here is where we have the advantage that accrues from taking precepts. Because, you know, if we've taken a precept not to do a certain action and we're not doing it, we are accumulating, you know, virtue. Just by the fact of not doing it, okay? Because the abstention from the non-virtues is in fact virtuous. Okay. In addition, doing the opposite of the 10 non-virtues becomes something virtuous. So instead of killing, preserving life. Instead of stealing, guarding others' possessions or respecting their possessions. Instead of unwise and unkind sexual behavior, wise and kind sexual behavior or celibacy. Instead of lying, telling the truth, and so on. Okay? Okay, so those are the 10 virtues. So, again, go back and think about when we've done any of the 10 virtuous paths of action and go through the 4 things. What was my object? How about my attitude or intention? Did it have the 3 factors under it? What was the action itself? What was the completion of the action? So go through and make examples in your life of doing that. Okay? And then pat yourself on the back, because we should definitely rejoice when we've done something virtuous. Yeah? It's not being arrogant, it's being practical. Yeah, we should definitely rejoice. Okay, then there's some actions that are neutral, that we do with no particular motivation, no particular virtuous or non-virtuous mental factor, like sweeping the floor or, doing the dishes or walking down the road or whatever. So these don't bring either good results or, favorable results or unfavorable results. And it's the thought training practice which gives us the opportunity to transform a lot of these neutral actions into virtuous ones. Okay, so when we've been doing the 41 prayers of bodhisattvas, those are all teachings on how to transform neutral ones. Okay, when you enter a building, I'm entering the citadel of liberation. Yeah, you're going up the stairs, I'm leading sentient beings to upper rebirth. Okay, seeing a full container, I'm seeing, may all sentient beings be filled with good qualities. All these different kinds of things are ways of transforming neutral actions. Okay, so this is the same thing. I was telling Champel yesterday about my experience doing 100,000 water bowls, and how I was so bored at one point doing them, sitting there or standing there, going, "Why in the world am I filling these cups full of water and dumping the water out? This doesn't make any sense." Okay. And so that's because when I was doing it, it was a completely neutral action. I mean, I kind of generated bodhicitta at the beginning, but then I forgot about my bodhicitta, and I was just filling cups with water and emptying the water out, which is a neutral action. Okay? Yeah? And that's the power of trying to get your mind to focus on what it should be thinking about when you're doing things like that. Because that's what transforms it into a virtuous action. So you're thinking that you're filling the Buddhas with bliss, or filling the sentient beings with purifying nectar, or you're meditating on emptiness, or, thinking something else like that. Meditating on making offerings and imagining beautiful offerings. Okay, so it's the mind that transforms those actions into something virtuous. Okay? Yeah. This is also, by the way, why we often do these practices in front of a Buddha statue. Because just the fact of having the Buddha statue, the imprint of that, by the power of the holy object, even if our mind is neutral, we're still doing something virtuous. We started out with some good intention. We're sitting in front of a Buddha statue. It's putting good imprints in their mind. So there's some virtue there. But it's really what's going on in our minds while we're doing it that's going to transform it from a neutral action into something where we really create some good karma. Okay, so the same thing applies to mandala offerings, prostrations, saying your mantra, whatever, There's some virtue in there because you got yourself there to do it. But, if you really want to make it virtuous and not let it just drift off into some neutral action, then you know, try and be aware of what your intention is, what your thought is, and keep your mind in the Dharma when you're doing it. As we know, this is not easy. The mind very happily gets distracted to all sorts of other things when it should be thinking about the prostration or the mandala offering or the mantra. Okay, but this is the whole thing about continually bringing the mind back again and again and again and again. Okay. Yeah. Of course, if when you're doing some practice like this, you have a distraction that is really kind of, you know, some strong affliction comes up in your mind and your mind is like really going off in left field, so that whenever you bring it back, it just keeps going back there, then what you need to do is, you know, for a temporary period of time, leave your present object of meditation and deal with that affliction. Okay, so there's a number of ways you can deal with that affliction, you know, or maybe it's a memory coming up in your mind, but there's always affliction accompanying it, you know, which is why the mind keeps going back to it, because we don't go back to just any memory. There's usually some juicy affliction involved in it that keeps our interest, okay, some ill will or some resentment or some, you know, craving for past pleasure or who knows what it is, but the, you know, mind keeps going back to it. So in if you're having that happen in your meditation, then a few ways to deal with it. Number one is know what the antidote to that particular affliction is and meditate on that antidote. So if you're having a lot of anger and resentment, meditate on patience, meditate on loving kindness. So there you have to choose one of the different meditations on patience to do. Okay? If you're having a lot of attachment come in your mind, yeah, then depending upon what kind of attachment is, if it's sexual attachment, then do the meditation on the parts of the body. If it's attachment to having possessions, then think of how those things are impermanent and how many more problems you have when you have them. Okay? So all those different, you know, antidotes, we've gone over this many, many times before. Okay? If you can't remember what the antidotes are to a particular affliction, go look it up. Okay? Don't just sit there and say, well, I can't remember, so I'll just sit here and enjoy my affliction. You know? Because you're usually pretty miserable when the mind's afflicted. Another way to deal with the affliction is to train your mindfulness on the affliction, okay, and then examine the affliction itself, okay. So you might have some resentment, you know, you're remembering a fight you had with somebody, you know, who knows how many years ago, or somebody who betrayed your trust how many years ago. So some resentment's coming up. So then focus your mindfulness on the resentment and examine, well, what is resentment? You know, how do I know that I'm feeling resentment? On what basis am I calling this resentment? What does resentment feel like? What does it feel like in my body? What flavor is there in my mind? What kind of thoughts are going on with this resentment? Yeah. Do I have resentment often? Is this a very familiar emotion? And if so, what's the pattern that I have that my mind goes so easily to this emotion? Okay? So what you're doing is you're turning your mindfulness and your wisdom onto the affliction itself, becoming familiar with it, you know, dissecting it, understanding what it is. Because lots of times we say, I'm angry, but we've never stopped to feel like, well, what does anger feel like? How do I know I'm angry? Yeah? And I remember one person telling me that when she was first learning a lot of this stuff, she knew she had emotions, but she didn't know what words to put to identify different emotions. You know, because depending upon how we were raised, some of us may have been raised where people were giving us the vocabulary to identify what we were feeling, and some people were raised where, you know, our parents or teachers or whatever didn't give us the vocabulary to be able to identify the emotions. And so then we need to really sit and think, you know, and then we might go to the mind and mental factors and learn the definition of different things and then see if that definition describes any of the things that we're feeling, so that we can learn the words to put on the different emotions that we're having. Yeah, that can be very, very helpful. Okay? And then, you know, it also helps us differentiate between different emotions, because sometimes we put the wrong label on an emotion. Yeah? And then we get very, very confused. And we'll think that something virtuous is non-virtuous because we put the wrong label on it. Or we'll think something non-virtuous is virtuous because we put the wrong label on it. Okay? So this is all a way to, you know, use the factors of mindfulness and also this clear comprehension or this one, Samprajana, who I still don't have a good translation for, you know, for helping us to understand how our mind is operating. Okay? Okay. So, transforming neutral actions into virtuous actions. I also thought that I would mention, because in the Pali tradition, they also have a list beyond the 10 virtues that are the abstention of the 10 non-virtues. They have a list of 10 virtuous actions, which I thought that I would go through. Which you know, again, it gives us ideas of things to cultivate. So the first one is generosity. Yeah, so just to think about, you know, whenever we're generous, we're doing a virtuous action. Of course, our generosity has to be, you know, of the right kind of thing. If we're giving arms to a drug dealer, that's not, you know, generosity, okay? If we're giving booze to a drunk, that's not generosity. So, you know, don't just think it's giving. There's certain qualifications in there. Okay, second one is ethical conduct. Third is meditation. Okay, trying to focus the mind. Fourth is cultivating humility and reverence. Oh, Americans don't like that one. But actually, that's what we need more as a country, don't we? Yeah? I mean, just as a country, I think if we had more humility and reverence for things that are worthy of reverence, that as a country we would be much, much better off. Yeah. I was reading, there was one editorial, I'm going on a tangent here, one editorial recently in the New York Times, and the guy who wrote it was saying, you know, we're kind of in bad shape, I mean, with all this financial crisis and consumer debt and everything, and saying, you know, we really need to, you know, look at our policies in many ways and our domestic policies and really reform things and then put our intelligence to, you know, on infrastructure, on, you know, on green development and so forth. And I was thinking, he had many good suggestions. I agreed with all of them, you know, different things that we can do as a nation. But I was also thinking that it's not just what we need to do as a nation. It's something about our attitude as a nation, you know. And our attitude has gotten too much into immediate pleasure, and that's what's led to this whole thing of consumer debt. It's gotten too much into greed and money being the standard for personal success, and that's what's led to this whole financial mess with the automobile agencies and the insurance and Wall Street. That we need to come back to our basic values and really renovate those. So it's not just where we put our talent in developing new things, but a shift, you know. And I think patriotism isn't just going out and going rah-rah for your troops, you know, because I think that's like, you know, rah-rah, go kill somebody. I think patriotism is working for the common good of everybody in this nation. Yeah. So if you want to be patriotic, you have to be altruistic. You know, and we have to move beyond just taking care of ourselves and our own immediate situation. Yeah. So that's what this thing of humility and reverence comes in there, doesn't it? You know? Kind of looking beyond our own nose. Because we can do all the research we want into green energy and into building more infrastructure, but if we don't change our attitude and we remain so self-centered and focused on immediate pleasure, you know, we're not going to be able to pull out of the mess we're in. I was thinking that I should write some reaction to that guy's editorial, but I never got around to it. You know, but I was thinking, well, of course, they'd never print me in the New York Times. I want to be printed in the New York Times. Oh, humility and reverence? Anyway, they aren't my ideas. They're the Buddha's ideas, so I can't even take credit for it. Okay, then the fifth is offering service. Okay. So that's something that's very good, offering service to other sentient beings. That's what we're doing here. Six is rejoicing at virtue, our own and others. Seven is dedicating merit. Eight is listening to Dharma teachings. Nine is teaching the Dharma, you know, leading discussion groups, leading meditations. And 10 is straightening out our views. In other words, cultivating correct views. And correct views are really, really important, you know. When we think of the three principal aspects of the path, correct view is the last one. But when you look at the Eightfold, the Noble Eightfold Path, correct view is the first one. And it cycles around and also becomes the last one. But the correct view is important at the beginning of our practice so that we have a correct understanding of a correct worldview. You know, we have the view that mind and body are different continuums. Yeah, we have the view of rebirth, of karma, yeah, of the fact that our mental actions create our happiness and suffering, you know, and our physical and verbal actions do too. So, you know, this whole worldview that of, you know, what is samsara? What is nirvana? How do we get out of samsara and enter nirvana? What is enlightenment? You know, so this whole thing is something actually that's quite important, because if we don't have that worldview, then we may try and create virtuous actions, but we're going to be bumping up against all of our wrong views. Okay? Because we're full of wrong views, aren't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah? And we can multiply our wrong views very easily. You know, we have multiplying mantras. We have the mind that multiplies its wrong views. Yeah, and we can do it, you know. And the mind of confusion, the mind of, and especially when our confusion's been influenced by attachment and anger, we can manufacture all sorts of wrong views. You know, like killing the enemy will give you a good rebirth. Yeah. Out of hatred, you're manufacturing a wrong view. Yeah? Or, what's one? Oh, how we manufacture our worldview out of our attachment also. You know? Like, oh, drinking and drugging isn't anything that's harmful. You know? Selling alcohol to other people isn't anything that's harmful. It's giving them pleasure. You know, it's a wrong view, isn't it? But it's a wrong view motive, kind of backed by our attachment. Okay? So what I'm getting at is developing a correct view at the beginning is very, very helpful and very important because it steers the rest of the practice we're going to do. And then, of course, we come around that's kind of a one level of correct view that deals with the conventional functioning of things. And then, of course, later on in our practice, we come around to correct view again, this time thinking about ultimate truths and what is the real nature of reality. And that's the, you know, ultimate correct view that we're going to be, that we come around to when we're meditating on emptiness. Okay? A correct view at the beginning of the practice is also very important. Yeah. Okay. Then, things, let's see, we only have 5 minutes left. Do you have any questions?
I have one question. Uh-huh. Sometimes we've heard that rejoicing is a part of the completing karma, of the completion mm-hmm. of the action. Does that come under completion, or is there a different list for rejoicing at the end?
Oh, okay. So sometimes we hear that rejoicing is the factor of the completion of the action. It's not necessarily that the rejoicing is an extra added oomph we give to the weight of the karma, but if we intend to kill some being and it dies before we do, whether we rejoice at that point or not, it's the completion of the action. Of course, if we have regret at that point, it's going to make the karma much lighter. And if we rejoice at that point, it's going to make the karma much heavier. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the notion of collective karma?
Oh, collective karma. Okay. So we have collective and individual karma. Collective karma is what the karma that we create as part of a group. So right now there's a group doing retreat. Okay? We are creating collective karma. Yeah. Now, the karma we create is going to depend, whether it's virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral, is going to depend upon what was the reason why this group formed. Okay? In our case, the reason why our group formed was to do Dharma practice, to benefit sentient beings, to attain enlightenment. So therefore, we create some virtuous collective karma by being part of this group. And all the people who are doing retreat from afar, you're also creating virtuous karma by choosing to be part of this group which is coming together for a virtuous reason. Some groups come together for a non-virtuous reason. You know, we're going to come together like a gang, you know. We're going to come together to protect our turf and chase away the enemies. Yeah. So then when you join that kind of group for that kind of reason, yeah, then you're sharing in the karma of the group and you're creating karma together that you often experience together. Okay? So there's a few things here. One is that we often will create karma in a group that we will then experience the result of in a group. Yeah. So why are the 16 of us here together plus how many people do we have on retreat from afar?
103.
We need 5 more to make it 108. Any volunteers? Okay. So, yeah. So all these people, you know, we're creating karma together and we could experience the result together in a future time. Or we could look at it as, why are we all together now doing this retreat? Because we've done some action, virtuous action, together in the past. Yeah? That's allowing us to meet together for these kinds of situations. Yeah. So, you know, when I go to teachings by His Holiness and there's thousands of people there coming together, I really feel this power of joining in, you know, with meeting with other people who have some kind of virtuous intention somewhere along the line. Okay? Now, but you also have to agree with the intention of the group to collect the karma from it. Okay? Because some groups we find ourselves being part of without our consent. For example, Washington State executes the capital punishment. Well, I don't agree with that. Yeah. So when the state does capital punishment, you know, I am not a resident of Washington State because I agree with that particular law and favor it. So I don't create the karma of the, you know, killing when the state executes somebody. But people who agree with that and support that, that's the thing of rejoicing at non-virtue or rejoicing at virtue, is you accumulate some of the karma, you know, from rejoicing at that. Now, within our collective karma, there's also individual karma. Okay? There's 16 of us here, human beings for the retreat, and there's two cats, and how many turkeys, Venerable Semke?
It's got 21 right now.
21 turkeys. Very auspicious number. 21 turkeys. Yeah. We hope it doubles by the end of the retreat. Yeah, she will collect more disciples. She feeds them. Okay. But so here we have some collective karma, and we also have some individual karma. Why were the kitties born as kitties and not as humans? They clearly have some karma to meet the Dharma, but not as human beings. You know, in the monasteries, they usually say it's the monastics who don't keep their vows well who get born as animals. Okay, so that means we need to be careful. Otherwise, we'll have more animals instead of more monastics. We don't want it that way, okay? So there we're talking about the results of the karma. But also in terms of the creation of the karma, we're all here together, but so we're creating some collective karma, some group karma, but we all have our own individual thoughts too. And in one meditation session, one person's mind can be very, very virtuous, and another person's mind may be sitting there just, you know, kind of angry and upset and criticizing and So, you know, within this thing of creating group karma, we all also create individual karma. And we also experience the result of our individual karma too, don't we? Yeah? Because you can see that in the meditation hall. How, you know, one day, oh, one person's very happy, another person's miserable. You know, nothing's changed. Then the next day, that miserable person's very happy and the first person's miserable. Again, nothing has changed except the mind, of course. But, you know, so the moods change according to karma, according to the way we're thinking. How we deal with the ripening of karma will influence the moods that we experience. Okay. So we have to stop now. So people are welcome to write in questions. And please do the homework. Yeah. So make some examples of the 10 virtues and the 10 non-virtues and through the 4 points, you know, from your own lives. And then we'll continue talking some more about karma in the upcoming weeks, because it's an important topic, and I think that it's good to hear about it again and again and again, because it makes us much more conscientious, much more careful with our actions. It gives us a much better understanding of why things are the way they are, and it gives us much more energy to take responsibility for our experience. Yeah? So that we either don't take our good circumstances for granted or whine about our bad circumstances. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all our inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spirit
spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Siddham
Guru Ratnam Mandalam Miryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the horn have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tensing gouts of Genesee, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abhi in the West world.